Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns. Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Okay, dear colleagues, can I ask you to take your seats? We can start this last plenary before the elections. I would like to take this opportunity to thank you all for your tireless work over the past 5 years.
We have debated. Wow. It's only been 5 years. I mean, that's a thing that I just cannot wrap my mind around when I think about how this European Parliament is wrapping up its final session in Strasbourg before heading to the elections. And Roberta Metsola, who we just heard talking, she's actually only been president of it for half of that time. We have been through so much over that 5 years. Guys, when this Parliament first took their chairs, Brexit was the big issue that we were talking about.
Challenging, but this parliament has delivered.
But then when Metsola kind of wrapped up the big issues, it didn't even make the list.
Yes, we have navigated our way out of COVID restrictions. We have faced the invasion of Ukraine, decoupled from Russia.
Policy-wise, MEPs navigated huge issues like tech, climate, and migration. And the institution also suffered embarrassing scandals and allegations of foreign interference. So, looking back, how did this European Parliament perform? Despite being the only directly elected EU body, is it still just a junior partner to the Commission and the European Council? Or did this batch of MEPs manage to earn a more powerful position? I'm Sarah Wheaton, host of EU Confidential. This week, I assembled a mega panel of my Politico colleagues to take a little mosey down memory lane and compare notes on this parliament. What did they do and what did they kind of screw up? We'll also check in on which MEPs deserve Politico's special unawards. You know, some of them have been, well, kind of lousy at their jobs. They've been lazy, failed to turn up for votes, landed behind bars, or even engaged in illegal meetings with interested parties. Oh no, that's not code for lobbying. I'm talking about orgies.
Sex, drugs, and hypocrisy. Belgian prosecutors still deciding whether to bring charges against a Hungarian MEP who attended what appears to be a gay orgy during lockdown.
All right, I am here with a mega panel of Politicos. I think fortunately everybody between gender and nationality, everybody's voice sounds fairly different, so everybody should be able to keep track. But sitting here with me in the studio is Nick Vinegar, editor at large.
Hi.
Hannah Kukulere.
Yeah, great.
Data reporter. Approving my Flemish pronunciation there. Louise Guillot, our sustainability reporter here.
Hi.
And joining us remotely is Joanna Roberts, pro editor.
Hi, Sarah.
And from Strasbourg, during this intense last week of this parliament, Eddie Wax. Eddie, how are you holding up?
Almost at the finish line.
Almost at the finish line. Can you describe the scene there? What's going on?
Yeah, there's a very busy plenary with lots of votes. I think a record number of almost 90 votes taking place this week. There is a valedictory atmosphere. There's lots of, you know, knowing nods to people and people asking each other about how the race is shaping up in different countries. There's a few MEPs, or many MEPs, who won't be coming back. So they're trying to get in the last punches to their rivals just as the final bell is tolling.
Any examples of these last punches?
Well, Philippe Lamberts, who's ending a 15-year career in the parliament, he's now the co-head of the Greens. He used the word bullshit probably a record-breaking number of times in a press conference, really went out in a blaze of fire attacking the new fiscal rules that the EU is bringing in.
Bullshit. Absolute bullshit. This is an absolute.
So that's one person who's not going out quietly.
Yeah, some people keep it classy to the end and others just choose to lower the level of discourse on their way out. Nice job. And actually, we are looking at MEPs who did well to the end versus maybe didn't really do such a hot job with our Politico on awards, which is this huge data analysis. Hannah, you were one of the main reporters involved in putting this whole thing together. Can you tell us about the on awards?
Okay, so we at Politico, we have this vast amount of data at our disposal on the Pro platform. It records everything from the amendments that MEPs file to the negotiations that they lead. And all of this data has been sitting there. So what we did was go through all of those data to see how individual MEPs performed on specific issues. So, for example, who talked the most in the plenary, who filed the most amendments alone or together with other groups. And on the flip side, who did the least of all of that as well.
Well, that's a perfect segue into Louise. You wrote the award for the person who voted the least. He had a very straightforward excuse.
Indeed. So the MEP who got the biggest no-show and the award for missing the most votes is Greek MEP Ioannis Lagos. And he missed more than 60% of the plenary votes this mandate. And his excuse is that, well, he's in jail. He's sitting behind bars since 2021. He's actually serving a 13-year sentence in a Greek prison for being the co-founder and also co-leader of the Golden Dawn in Greece, which is an extreme right party. So yeah, definitely biggest no-show. But he's actually not the only MEP who missed vote for being behind bars. Another Greek MEP did that too. It's Eva Kaili. She was temporarily behind bars as part of the Carragate investigation.
Yeah, and what I thought was really interesting was that Lagos was still able to cast some votes at one point from jail because of the COVID era remote voting system. But I want to go back to Eva Kaili, who you mentioned. She also won an award, a kind of an ironic pairing. She was named one of our brand ambassadors. Eddie, can you tell us about her and her co-brand ambassador for the European Parliament?
So some awards are probably more tongue-in-cheek than others. I think Roberta Metsola is not the most interesting choice, given that she literally is the face of the parliament as its president since 2022. She is from Malta. She's an EPP lawmaker. And, you know, her job is to represent the parliament. She is the institutional figurehead. But I thought it would be interesting to pair her with Eva Kaili because Eva Kaili, you know, is kind of represents the other side, the more dark, the more suspicious side of things.
Eva Kaili. A Greek member of parliament is expected to be in Brussels court today.
She was allegedly caught with bags of cash at her home. Investigators believe this was money she received from Qatar in return for supporting the country in debates at the European Parliament.
She denies any allegations and she says that this whole thing, Qatargate, has been a stitch-up actually targeting the parliament. So Kylie's biggest argument now, as she kind of awaits trial or awaits the next twist in this Belgian, you know, criminal case, is that she's making herself out to be sort of ambassador for the parliament as well. So there's sort of two ambassadors, one unofficial and one official. And the fact is that their political lives have overlapped quite a lot. I mean, Kaili became a vice president at the same time that Metsola became president of the parliament. And actually, due to Qatargate crashing, Metsola had to spend a lot of her political energy clearing up the work that Kaili and other people allegedly in this corruption network created for her. So that's why I think they're two interesting counterpoints to compare.
Yeah, and those are two people who really are representing the parliament, representing something bigger than themselves. But we have one prize for somebody who just really showed they were going their own way. Joanna, can you talk us about our biggest rebel award?
Yeah, so our biggest rebel award goes to the MEP who voted against their own political group the most. So as you know, these MEPs in political parties unite in the parliament to form these groupings. And the idea of the groupings is that they sort of all move with one in one direction so they can hold the most power. And this MEP voted against his own grouping the most times, according to our data. And he is Ivan David. He's a Czech psychiatrist and far-right lawmaker, so he belongs to the far-right Identity and Democracy group.
Přesvědčen, že hlavním problémem Evropské unie jsou Green Deal a masová imigrace.
And he voted against his group's sort of majority position 4,406 times, which is 41% of the time. That's sort of, you know, something in itself. But I think what's quite interesting that came out of the data is the top 10 rebels, so the 10 MPs who voted against their group the majority of the time, were all from either the European Conservatives and Reformists right-wing group or the far-right Identity and Democracy group. So the top 10 spots were all taken by right-wing MEPs. By contrast, the Greens were the most disciplined group. So that's quite interesting if you think of the projected rightward shift of the next parliament, this sort of thoughts about them being a bloc. But what we see when we look at the figures is actually they're people who like to assert their individual opinions.
Well, I think that also shows you that a lot of people who are elected to the European Parliament don't care so much about being members of a European Parliament. They care more about representing their country. Don't know if that's the case of Ivan David, but I do think that especially in the ECR group, they pride themselves on being national sovereigntists. I mean, and that's what they want to put forward. So in that sense, I don't think it's that surprising that some people within the ECR or within the ID group would vote against each other's interests, because for them, it's not so important to have the unity of the group. What's important is to do what's right as they see it for Italy or Germany.
And that's going to be a dynamic that we're going to have to watch going forward if these groups do end up, you know, gaining much more power in the parliament. It'll make it a lot less predictable. Hannah, you know, in the theme of MEPs doing their jobs and how they do it, we have these two awards that capture extremely different approaches. Can you talk about our Chatterbox Award and then tell us about our Invisibility Award?
So we went through the data to see how much MEPs had spoken in plenary, and our number one might be quite obvious because she is the president of the second largest group in the European Parliament. Irache García Pérez.
Gracias, Presidenta. El próximo jueves 25 de abril, coincidiendo con el 50 aniversario...
According to our data, she pronounced a total of 96,255 words that would be enough to fill a novel. And then we also looked at the opposite end, because we had been looking into the amendments MEPs had filed, the negotiations they had led. But for our Invisibility Award, actually, we flipped that around and we looked at the MEPs that showed up lower or very much at the bottom end of their ranking. We found one MEP who really stood out. So the MEP who had negotiated the fewest files, who'd submitted the fewest amendments, who'd asked the fewest written questions. That was Nico Zemsroth, a German MEP who sits with the Greens. He was elected as an MEP for the German party Die Partei, which is a satirical party which never really ran on a legislative platform.
The EU is in deep crisis, and so am I. We should take a lesson from the Eurovision Song Contest. People pay attention to naked people dancing. From the broken heart of Europe, I am Nico Zemsroth.
So he's quite an unusual MEP, and what he has been active on is transparency, for instance. Transparency on MEPs' budgets, strange procedural rules within the parliament that frustrated him quite a lot. He definitely doesn't want to run again. He hated every second in the parliament, I think.
Nick, I want to bring it over to you. Something that definitely none of us would have predicted, the most traumatic exit. Can you talk to us about that award?
Yeah, I just want to say that I really take the prize here with the wildest exit, because I think everybody remembers this story. In the midst of the pandemic, a Hungarian MEP who belonged to Viktor Orban's party, ultra-conservative, was arrested fleeing the scene of an orgy with illegal drugs in his backpack. And it happened to be in breach of the lockdown as well. So a kind of double infraction there. And he was found trying to escape this place with a backpack. I'm not sure if he was fully dressed, had no ID documents on him, was taken back to his residence where he showed a diplomatic passport.
Fidesz MEP Jozef Szájer has admitted to violating COVID-19 restrictions by attending a sex party. Police were called to an apartment on Friday night in Brussels. They found 25 people there, mostly men. Szájer tried to escape along a roof gutter.
He was no longer welcome in Orban's party, but it did really liven up that week in any case in Brussels.
Yeah, there was a lot of schadenfreude going on because he was caught at this gay orgy, basically, and he'd been responsible for, people said, for a lot of anti-LGBT legislation and rhetoric coming out of Hungary.
All of that. It was the perfect story, the hypocrisy and so on. That was probably one of the high points of the whole legislature in terms of news and funny things happening.
Well, certainly high point, low point, you know, it all depends on your perspective, really. Let's try to get a little classier, elevate the level of our discourse again by talking about some of maybe the historical high points or legislative high points, because just as we were preparing for this episode, I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe this one parliament has only been around for 5 years. We're going to embrace some of the high points, some of the historically important moments when we come back from the break. Stay with us.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
So thanks for staying with us. I'm back with our huge panel of a million different politicos, among them Nick Vinokur, who is going to help us reflect on the way this parliament started, which is just still hard to wrap your head around when you think about it. But pre-pandemic, the thing we're all talking about was Brexit.
Yeah, it feels like a lifetime ago. I think looking back over the past 5 years, people have felt a real loss from Brexit in Parliament. People talked about the British contingent being very well versed in sort of parliamentary activity, the role of Parliament, holding other institutions to account, asking questions, legal action, things like that. And with the departure of the Brits, they felt that, well, some of that experience and that kind of know-how and a fighting spirit has left the Parliament. And I think there's a real concern now that it could be lost and not recovered, because there are only a few voices in Parliament that really care about institutional accountability. And we don't know if those people are coming back, actually.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that actually last time the EU held an election, Nigel Farage was elected, even though that was well after the referendum votes where the UK, you know, decided to leave the EU. So Nigel Farage was actually elected as part of the Brexit party. And then that created, you know, a lot more kind of ructions in the parliament, because those 73 British MEPs were only around for a while. And then when the UK officially left, all those MEPs left and some new ones came in. There was a reshuffling of all the seats.
So this is it, the final chapter, the end of the road, a 47-year political experiment that the British, frankly, have never been very happy with. Once we've left, we are never coming back, and the rest, frankly, is detail.
Yeah, I think I agree with what Nick said, that the character of the parliament has changed a bit. You know, we used to have those fierce clashes in the plenary between Nigel Farage and Guy Verhofstadt, who is another MEP who's unlikely to come back after these elections.
The only way is there is Mr. Farage. That's a surprise for me, because I thought that he was marching somewhere in Britain. And he is here, a 200 miles march. How many miles you have done? 2 miles, you think? Something like that?
So I think there's less of that sort of parliamentary debating spirit that I think some countries like the Danes and the Dutch certainly do like. The French MEPs have a very different sense of what a parliament is for. German MEPs tend to be very kind of fond, especially on the EPP side, of this idea of the freedom of the mandate. So yeah, I think that the character of the parliament is slowly changing, definitely.
Yeah, and Brexit kind of officially set in on January 31st, 2020. And then late February 2020, that's when the pandemic set in. And that, of course, profoundly changed the character of the parliament as well, prompted a lot of debates about what the parliament should be doing and how it should be functioning. And I'm going to take the chair's right to monologue a little bit here, but I wrote an article about the switch to remote work in the parliament, the switch to remote voting in the parliament. And there was this whole discussion about, quote unquote, parliamentarism. Do people actually need to be there physically to be debating with each other, to be talking with each other, to have this Europe where everybody from all the different member countries come together into one place? Or is it better to have a parliament of the member states where the MEPs actually stay in their member state and stay connected to the people, and then they can just log in to vote remotely, but while still kind of communing with their neighbors? And this is actually reminding me of one of our unawards, which was for the person who did the fewest votes. Louise?
Actually, one of the runner-ups, MEPs who didn't show up much to vote this time around, is... it's an Hungarian MEP from the Socialist and Democrat. His name is István Hujeli. And when we ask him why he didn't show up as much to plenary to vote, he said, well, he's been very busy attending events and going to meetings with associations, businesses, to talk about his work as an MEP and promote his policies. And often these events would clash with plenary weeks, meaning he couldn't be in two places at the same time. So he had to pick. And he often picked, indeed, going to these events.
Yeah, and Eddie, you've been doing some reporting on efforts in the next parliament to get people to show up in person.
Yes, there's been a whole series of reforms driven by the Secretary General of the Parliament, which passed a few weeks ago to try and sex up the plenary and get people to show up. Actually, there was a lot of stuff on social media on Tuesday morning when Ursula von der Leyen came to the plenary and it was basically empty. And there are a lot of people saying that this is terrible PR for the parliament. But it's not just because MEPs, you know, want to have a beer at 11 a.m. in the Swan Bar. It's also because they also have lots of parallel activities going on, which makes it difficult for them to show up in the plenary. But I think the main problem with the plenary is that there's not a proper debate. I mean, the whole structure of it is mostly that you come in, you do your 1 minute speech, and then you leave. So being in the room for 1 minute doesn't really create a great sort of debating atmosphere, does it?
But Eddie, don't you think that the fact that the parliament has implemented this new system with blue cards where MEP can react quickly to what their counterparts have been saying during debates, don't you think that it's been improving a bit the interactivity of plenary sittings?
No, I think you're right, Louise. I mean, I personally like the blue card system. It at least gives a little frisson of something, of some kind of serious back and forth and a bit of a Q&A. Part of the problem with the parliament as well is that the timetable is so rigid, but also it can change at the last minute. So that makes it difficult for journalists to cover it. There's plenty of problems. One of the problems is that there are also so many MEPs. So, you know, it's hard to cater to debate where you have 150 people wanting to weigh in.
Well, the fact that we have so many MEPs doesn't always necessarily mean that the parliament is actually that powerful. And Joanna, I remember you saying one of your takeaways from this parliament during COVID was the COVID committee and its efforts. Can you walk us through that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, the COVID committee was set up in March 2022 to actually sort of scrutinize what the commission was doing in terms of the pandemic and response to it. And I think it's interesting because it was a temporary committee. It's ended now. It ended last July. But it really gave a little snapshot of just how impotent the parliament really is in scrutinizing and holding other bodies to account. So this is really exemplified in two of the issues the COVID committee were looking at. One is around how the vaccine contracts were actually negotiated. And this is the famous Pfizergate issue that's still haunting Ursula von der Leyen. And this is about how the New York Times reported that Ursula von der Leyen allegedly exchanged text messages with Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla in the run-up to signing a contract for up to 1.1 billion doses. There were lots of questions about the suitability of using text messages to conduct negotiations. And the COVID committee tried to compel both Albert Bourla twice and Ursula von der Leyen to come and talk to the committee and talk about what had happened. Bourla refused twice because the parliament doesn't have the ability to compel people to come and appear in front of the committees. And Ursula von der Leyen, that request went to Roberta Metsola for approval, who is of the same political grouping as Ursula von der Leyen. And eventually an arrangement was made where von der Leyen went in private to talk to the conference and president. So it's not only when Ursula von der Leyen turns up, there are no parliamentarians there, but also she doesn't like to turn up when the parliamentarians ask her to sometimes. And then the other issue is the actual details of the contracts, which the MEPs on the COVID committee said they wanted to see. The commission refused to reveal confidential commercial information. And in the end, a select group of MEPs from the COVID committee were verbally briefed on the details of the contracts in private, unbeknownst to other members of the COVID committee. So even within the committees, there was a lot of secrecy and lack of transparency. And this thing, you know, it's not just about procedural issues, because there are real repercussions. You know, European countries have destroyed 4 billion euros worth of vaccines. You know, it's a huge cost. All the issues around the vaccine contracts and transparency and scrutiny, it's just a little microcosm of how the parliament does try, but even when it tries its best, it often fails to hold the commission to account.
Not only was there a lack of coordination when it came to those big crises that we faced, COVID, the war in Ukraine, but those crises, I think, have really shown how much the parliament itself has been sidelined as a decision-making place. You know, of course, it has to sign off on the budget and it signs off on EU laws. But when push really comes to shove and it's existential, parliament wasn't involved in procuring vaccines, really. It wasn't involved in sanctioning Russia. It wasn't involved in providing weapons for Ukraine. So parliament has proven to be the junior decision-making body.
Yeah, and that's why perhaps some of us were chuckling at the irony a bit of Qatargate, because that was an alleged cash for influence scandal where there was a lot of effort to get MEPs to make nice comments. But it's unclear really, you know, what impact those favors actually had. Eddie, can you talk to us a bit about the legacy of Qatargate?
The legacy of Qatargate is still being written. It's still an active criminal case. But the legacy of Qatargate really is a reputational hit that the parliament had never seen before. It's a huge damage to the parliament's credibility, just as it wanted to step up and play this bigger role. But now, you know, people with all the stories coming out about MEPs, not just Qatargate, but now allegations about Russian interference, this week even allegations about Chinese interference, that means the other institutions are going to be looking at the parliament and thinking, you know, this proves what we thought all along, that these guys are not serious, that we can't really deal with them. And we certainly can't share sensitive information with them. So I think it's really, really bad news for the parliament. And, you know, I know they've instituted some internal reforms, but it's going to be a long, long road back for the European Parliament.
Despite the parliament's credibility issues, it remains the only directly elected institution in the European Union. In that sense, it is more responsive to politics. And so we did see the parliament exercise its power to sort of derail to some extent the commission's agenda on climate policy. And fortunately, Louise is our expert on that here. Louise, can you talk to us about the scene in Strasbourg with the Nature Restoration Act and kind of the big picture on what it says about climate politics right now?
So the first part of the mandate was really marked by a legislative bonanza around the Green Deal. Like, parliamentarians pushed dozens of files on climate issues. But when they turned to another part of the Green Deal, namely protecting nature, addressing biodiversity loss through the Nature Restoration Law, it hit a roadblock. Basically, what happened is that at the last minute, during parliamentary negotiation, the EPP, so the centre-right group, walk out of the negotiation room saying, you know, we're going nowhere, we're not satisfied with this deal, we don't want it anymore, which made passing this legislation really, really tough in parliament. So I recall during this parliamentary session in July last year, there was a very tight vote on the Nature Restoration Law. Basically, the European People's Party was trying to reject the Nature Restoration Law altogether. And everybody was counting votes in their own camps, trying to see whether they could find a majority in favor of it or against. And there was this allegation of the EPP leader, Manfred Weber, trying to pressure MEPs to vote against it.
We are not a rubber stamping machine on bad legislation. That's why we are asking for rejection.
But thanks to some MEPs rebelling to their boss, notably the Irish delegation within the EPP, the legislation eventually passed and then moved to very tense negotiation with the European countries. We still don't know whether there will be a majority among EU countries to actually adopt this legislation.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, because of the sort of institutional powerlessness, I think we've seen Parliament kind of rebel in, you know, several examples. There, the example that Louise just talked about, the EPP going against its own commission president. I find that pretty remarkable. But you also have efforts to sue the commission over Hungary aid. And I think moments like this that show the Parliament really trying to exert what leverage it does have over the commission and the member states. And I think even though the institutional framework hasn't changed, I think the Parliament's become more political and used its weight more and really leaned on von der Leyen, especially at the end of the term on the Green Deal and on migration.
Absolutely. Of course, there are some in the Parliament who have tried to maximize the rather limited role that the Parliament has and tried to push it to the edge. Guy Verhofstadt is a dab hand of that. Of course, Manfred Weber, the parliamentary leader of the EPP, is also, you know, very skilled in kind of exploiting all the little tips and tricks and rules that you can use to get as much kind of clout from the Parliament as possible, but it still remains the junior partner. There are some reforms being brought in to try and hold the Commission to account a bit more. And it's going to be interesting to see when the Parliament schedules the vote on the next Commission President nominee, whenever that is, because that is actually the first muscle flexing opportunity that the Parliament has. Do they sort of put them to the vote straight away in the first plenary week in July, or do they give them time to sweat over the summer and leave it until September? So, you know, the Parliament does certainly have a role to play at the beginning of the mandate. But once all the commissioners are in and they're all comfortably installed in their desks, then we really rarely tend to see a huge revolt in the Parliament. But it's who's going to draw first blood, basically. Which of the commission nominees is going to be sacrificed? I mean, that's going to be the question, you know, in the coming months.
So the point that Eddie was making about the Parliament's first and maybe best chance to have a lot of influence is when it votes for the Commission President and to approve the Commission President's choice of commissioners. And that leads us to looking ahead, looking into the crystal ball. What are people talking about as far as anticipating the next Parliament after the June elections? Nick, what are you hearing?
Well, people asking a lot of questions. How big is the far right group going to be? Are the polls going to get things wrong? Are we going to have multiple Geert Wilders situations? You know, in the Netherlands, the polls didn't show that Geert Wilders was going to win. So there's kind of anxiety around that, whether projections are telling us that the far right's going to get a bigger group. Could it be even bigger than that? And then the next question is, will the center hold? Are we going to get this center right, center left coalition still holding? Broadly speaking, the answer is yes, but there are uncertainties, size of the liberal group, and what about tie-ups between right-wing, far-right groups? How likely are those? Who knows? So quite a lot of uncertainty about what is the political shape of the Parliament going to be.
I just wanted to point out that polls did indicate that Wilders was going to win, just not by that much. You know, the size of his victory really took people by surprise because he pulled upwards massively in the final days before the election.
Anna, your point about polling just made me think of this kind of bigger question that we have about how reliable are the polls? When should we pay attention to them? And when should we just kind of say, oh, the only poll that matters is on election day? You're kind of one of the people wrangling the political poll of polls for us. What would your advice be to people who want to know how much attention to pay to them and when, and are they of different validity in different countries? Give us your wisdom.
Well, as a data reporter, I could never say don't look at the polls, but you do have to take them with a grain of salt, of course. That's also why we aggregate polls with the poll of polls, just to kind of limit the errors that could show up in a single poll. That doesn't mean that I'm considering the polls are going to be mirrored in the election results. They could basically be vastly different. We've seen in the past that people who are considering a vote for an anti-migration party are perhaps less likely to say so, even if it's an anonymized poll. Anti-migration parties do typically perform better than expected. So that could easily happen. Then again, who knows, there's still a few weeks to go. A lot could happen in a few weeks. We've seen that in the past as well. But they do show some trends to look at, not just of anti-migration parties, also Christian Democratic parties gradually becoming smaller, or the Greens kind of languishing in some countries.
And Eddie, let's end with you in Strasbourg. You talked a little bit about the valedictory vibe. Is there a sense of yay, we're about to kind of have a break or hit the campaign trail? Or is there more kind of a sense of dread of like, it's nice for now, but next time I see you, it might be pretty grim?
I think the sense here is that people are already in campaign mode. I mean, of course, they want to get their files across the line, but more than ever before, I've seen how people are using their votes and the files they are steering across the line to their own advantage, especially if they're, you know, trying to stay on in politics. A couple of Swedish MEPs held a press conference entitled simply "Ongoing Update About the Plenary." So people are just holding press conferences just to hold press conferences, basically, to get more attention. There's definitely a sort of campaigning vibe here. I'm seeing even campaign posters going up around the city. And I think most people's minds are fully on the next 6 weeks, which is where the campaigning will really take off.
All right. Well, we are going to get back to our own coverage of these last files and gear up for campaign mode. Thanks to all of you for helping to wrap our heads around this monster parliamentary mandate. Nick, Hannah, Louise, Eddie, Joanna, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, that's it for this European Parliament and for us. Well, we'll be back next week. Check out our show notes for the full list of the UN awards and for other interesting Parliament-related stories. And please make sure you follow us and rate us on your favorite app. And shoot us a message at podcast@politico.eu. I'm Sarah Wheaton. Thanks to Christina Gonzalez, Politico's deputy head of audio, and to Deanna Sturris, our senior audio producer. See you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.